You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today we'll be talking with Will Hilton, author of the book Vanished, The 60-Year Search for the Missing Men of World War II. It was just published this November by Riverhead Press, an imprint of Penguin. This is a book, fascinating book, about war, death, mystery, loss, closure. It's a sometimes, maybe oftentimes, heart-wrenching story of memories and unanswered questions involving the South Pacific, the war, B-24 bombers, and brave men who are no longer with us. Will is a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. Which is what it says on the blurb, but he's also contributed great stuff, much of which I've read, to Esquire, GQ, Harper's, and other periodicals. Welcome, Will. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Since I tend to go on, why don't I ask you first, why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about the book and how it arose and, you know, all the incredible research you did about it?
I guess the book focuses really on one missing airplane that vanished under somewhat mysterious circumstances during the campaign against Japan in World War II, so the Pacific War. And yet, that plane ends up being, in its absence, a sort of index by which you access all of these other pieces of the Pacific War and its long legacy of grief that's left behind among the families of the dead and the missing. And so over the course of the book, you follow the men aboard the plane on their missions and their final one over the islands of Palau, but then you also follow the search by family members, volunteer adventurers, and the military itself to figure out what really happened to it and where it ended up.
You know, I'm always interested in epigraphs because it almost seems like a wax seal or a thumbnail idea that the author had about what the book's about. And this epigraph actually is an epitaph that ties into terroir, which goes to an article that was published in the Times just a couple of weeks ago. But it reads, "When again bright morning dyes the sky and waving fronds above shall touch the rain, we give you this, that in these times we will remember." Which is incredibly poignant, but I was wondering how you did you come up with that during the writing of the book or in your research? Because it's only part of a much lengthier epitaph that I read yesterday on the web, which is beautifully written.
Yes, this is a poem that was written, it's handwritten,
yeah,
and was hung above one of the many cemeteries of American Marines on the Tarawa Atoll in what's now the Republic of Kiribati. And there were so many losses on this tiny, tiny little island in Tarawa Atoll called Beshia, that's the name of the island where the fighting took place. There was just so many losses that these American Marines had to be buried in mass graves after the fighting was over so that the island could be raised flat and converted into an airfield to continue the strikes against Japan. And so at the edge of this massive series of cemeteries and mass graves, an American officer wrote this poem and hung it up. And I find the whole poem touching. Those lines about the persistence of memory and the importance of memory for these lost and in some cases missing troops, really, really struck home. And when I used that line, it was only from my research, but, over the past month, I've actually been to Tarawa as part of a recovery, effort that's taking place there.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit before the show about the fact that an article about all this appeared in the Times on November 20th, which kind of dovetailed into this book, but deals with Tarawa and your research there and your visit there, correct?
That's right, yeah. So the article that appeared in the Times is focused almost exclusively on Tarawa, although the book is mostly about the Palau Islands.
Right.
I initially intended, and what we had discussed at the Times was that it would be nice to do an excerpt of the book in the Sunday magazine, and we started working on how that would appear, and And these developments were unfolding concurrently on Tarawa, which appear to be the largest collection of American MIAs ever recovered, or certainly will prove to be one of the largest. And as all this was happening, because I've been reporting in this sort of world of MIA recovery from the Pacific for so long, almost everyone who was involved in it, many of whom weren't speaking to each other, were speaking to me about what they were seeing and what they were finding. And so it was an opportunity to go and see this remarkable thing that they're putting together out there, where they may recover 500 and some American Marines, you know, 70 years, almost exactly 70 years after the fighting.
Yeah,
so I ended up focusing on that for the Times piece.
That brings up a really interesting question that I have about both Vanished and that article, and even going back to 2011 when you wrote the article, What Happened to Air France Flight 447, is that you seem to be almost two people, two authors, one of whom is very cold, clinical, incredible researcher with bibliographies and notes that run for dozens and dozens of pages, and the other person seems to be a deeply spiritual person who really understands the loss that these families have, the lack of closure, your desire to provide closure. Do you see that dichotomy in yourself?
I suppose I do. It's interesting that you put it that way. The way that I have processed it up to this point anyway is with this sort of astonishment by the extent to which my work as a reporter and as a journalist, which I've done for over 20 years now, has in this particular issue come to feel so personal. And so I suspect that what you see as the sort of clinical or detached author is the way that I've historically perceived myself. And then in 2008, when I first encountered this issue of MIAs and I first started to realize how many families are still out there, and it's a lot, it's tens of thousands of American families who are waiting to find out exactly what happened to a member of the armed forces that they saw off overseas and never found out what happened to them, that who are listed as missing. And this issue, for some reason, has touched me in a personal way, so that I find myself writing about this issue with a different tone than I often do as a journalist, and with a different state of mind than I often do as a journalist.
Yeah, and the last thing you appear to be is a compulsive or an obsessive person, but then Mr. Scannon in the book, who really does become obsessed with it, it's almost at some points that you kind of almost seem that way. And I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah, well, thanks. I think it's true. I mean, I feel like in some way I was lucky in trying to describe what is for Pat Scannon, I think, an obsessive kind of quest to find the missing planes of World War II and the men aboard. I think, you know, in trying to capture that, it helped in some way that I found myself swept up in the story and determined to piece together whatever parts of the story remain to be solved. When I first started reporting this in 2008, we were still a few years away from having most of the big answers to what had happened to this plane. So we had some sense of where most of the body of the plane was, but no idea what men, if any, were on board, how many had survived. It was clear that some had survived the crash, but not clear which ones or how many. And so in trying to help figure out the last set of riddles, I guess I became a little obsessed as well.
Yeah, it's like the tail being missing and then the excitement when the tail was found. It's almost palpable, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's
in the sense that, you know, even in these old letters home that these airmen wrote, they revealed things about their combat, which they weren't supposed to, but these subtle things about their combat experience, which turned out to be extremely important in identifying which members of the crew were to be found in which parts of the plane that were discovered, and which members of the crew might not be found in the parts of the plane that were not discovered. And I also found in those letters a much deeper sense of what lives the men had lived before they left, and they had a much better aspect from which to approach the sense of loss that their families felt for them specifically as individuals.
Yeah,
it became important to do that.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of love that especially, well, and we can talk about the Doyle family, but there's an enormous amount of love that you see in these letters, and a very unexpected, articulate aspect to those letters, with regard to people who are essentially blue-collar people whose vocabulary and syntax you wouldn't expect to see. And you bring that up, don't you?
I do. I was struck by it as well. The one of the members of the crew who I became sort of most in my mind close to is a guy named Jimmy Doyle. And Jimmy's son, Tommy, is a man. He's about 70 now. In West Texas, a football coach. And I've grown pretty close to Tommy, you know, in the real world. But in my research world, in my, you know, writer's world, I felt probably as closely connected to his father, Jimmy, who died at 25 in 1944, as to anyone in the book. Because I found that Jimmy was writing letters home so often, sometimes a couple a day to a single person, to his wife, and then others to other family members. He was writing so often that it was impossible for me to think of him as anything other than a writer. In other words, you write home partly out of love for your family and out of a desire to communicate these the sort of basics of what's going on. But if you write that much, it's because you're writing also for yourself to process and to think through what you're experiencing. And I felt very connected to Jimmy in that way. And then when I would think about the fact that he came from this incredibly poor depression era life with just his dad to raise him and pouring stone roads and building, you know, walls with his dad, who was a mason at a young age, and how little education Jimmy'd had. It was really striking to think that he was able to craft these letters that still reached me in such a personal place so long after.
Well, you know, it's funny because explaining his life and how hard it was before and obviously during, and the way his life ended, why don't you, as an aside, tell a little bit about the tragic aspects of Tommy's life as he was a young man and as he grew older?
Yeah, so Tommy is a sort of, his story is a sort of a perfect distillation in some ways of what can happen in an MIA case, and I think it's valuable to know what happened to Tommy in order to have an appreciation for what this feels like for families. In Tommy's particular case, he grew up hearing stories, at first as a young child, overhearing them within whispers, and then later hearing them overtly from his uncle, that Jimmy was not dead and would not be found on the plane if it were ever recovered, and that, in fact, his father, Jimmy, was living in California with a new wife and two daughters. And this was very specific information. There were stories that Jimmy had called the family to get updates on what was going on, and that the uncles had driven out to California to see him and just narrowly missed him, according to the story. Right after they got there, he was gone, but the landlord of the place confirmed that he had been living in this apartment complex. And so, you know, Tommy in that way grew up with this uncertainty that's, I think, emblematic of what the MIA experience is. When you don't know what's happened, these stories tend to arise in families. And you might be surprised how many MIA families have told me a story like this. I'd say it's probably 80% of the MIA families I've interviewed, there's at least some family member who's convinced of some particular story as to what they believe happened. And just often enough, it turns out to be true. You know, for 30 years after the war, some Japanese soldiers would continue to emerge from the jungles of the Pacific. And in 1994, an American MIA, a soldier, returned from North Korea after 30 years. So, you know, these kinds of examples can demonstrate for MIA families that thread of hope they're holding on to may prove right, and so the hope persists sometimes through multiple generations.
Yeah, and it's and this is where you go off sometimes, and it's very interesting the way you do it. Like Tommy's life itself, how he had such wonderful prospects. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, like the football issue?
So Tommy grew up without his dad then. And you know, his dad had grown up without his mom, and so this family was risen in multiple ways. And by the time Tommy was a little boy, his mother's heart was broken not only by the absence of his father Jimmy in the war, but by these questions, which she had heard, and she refused to speak about his dad. And so there was this very sort of gloomy atmosphere as pertains to Tommy's family life. His mother loved him and he loved his mother, but the rest of the pieces of the puzzle didn't quite fit together and he never knew why. And this one sort of bright light in his life was football. He was a very gifted football player. He ended up getting a full ride to Texas Tech, and he was a great player. He started off very strong. He was playing alongside guys who would end up being big superstars in the NFL. But he sustained a horrific series of injuries about the middle of his college experience, and he ended up having to leave the football team. He could never play again. And he wound up, instead of pursuing his dreams as a pro football player or his backup plan to join the Air Force, which was also ruled out by his knees and his shoulder injuries, he ended up coaching football for years and years, for 30, 40 years, and he was sort of your classic West Texas football coach, your Coach Taylor, if you will. I mean, he was not just teaching young men to play football, but he was teaching young men to be men and to have the integrity and courage on the field that would translate through the rest of their lives. And yet he told me that, you know, even after he had found this kind of peace in this new role as a sort of fatherly figure that he had never had himself, there, and having a family he loved, this question about his dad would never went away. It was always sort of there under the surface about, was it true, was it possible that his father had survived, and if he had survived, was it possible that he had abandoned the family? And if so, was there any explanation that could make it okay?
That's what I was fascinated with the book, is that you drill down, whether it's on that side, the human side, even to Tommy's son and his frail condition. But like, for example, another example would be, and obviously there's very little humor in this book, but there is when you talk about the B-24. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what the B-24 was like? And I watched the YouTube video last night of the Ford plant. What's it called? River?
Oh, Willow Run.
Yeah, Willow Run. And it was amazing. They turned out a B-24 every 53 minutes or something.
Isn't that stunning?
It's amazing.
It remains today the most produced multi-engine aircraft ever, which is particularly stunning when you think about the fact that it stopped being produced in 1945. I mean, it was only produced for a few years. But the need for these planes was so great. I mean, we couldn't win the Pacific War without good airplanes that could go a long distance. And I say good airplanes. I'm not sure very many people who ever flew on a B-24 would call it a good plane. They had a sort of a love-hate relationship.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of in terms of the humor, because you do describe it, you know, that way.
Yeah, when you hear about the fact that it could carry all these munitions over a 1,000-mile radius, it sounds pretty impressive.
Right.
They were these sort of huge, lumbering, you know, people called them a flying boxcar. This was just this blocky thing with a couple of wings sticking out that wasn't pressurized, so the wind would whistle through it. And these poor guys had to spend hours and hours on these horrible planes, which were also notorious for catching on fire if they were hit by anti-aircraft. And they, when they went down, you know, they would just break apart into a million pieces. So the guys on these planes kind of, they knew that. I mean, they would go on their first few missions and typically see these planes around them go down. And often a plane went down in the mission, at least one. And so every time they had to get on the plane the next time, and the time after that, and the time after that, they were conscious of this with incredible vulnerability that they had in the sky over enemy territory on this rickety old thing that could barely fly.
Yes, I looked at also at the footage, I guess some of the enhanced footage of, I don't know if it's your B-24, but as it was hit, the left wing coming off, and it is astonishing to watch. It just, it's scary.
Yeah, there's just nothing you can do, you know. I've talked to, for example, the family members of the pilot who was flying this particular plane that's the focus of my story, and they've asked me, you know, what could he have done? Could he have done anything different? It's just something that they can't help wondering, you know, did he ever have a chance? Was there anything he could have done? And The answer is definitely no. I mean, you know, you just are rolling the dice on one of these planes and you fly across an enemy island, a Japanese island with cannons pointing up, and you just fly through it. And it's, you know, it's like trying to run through the rain without getting wet.
Right.
You can't do it. And so they would get hit. And if they got hit in the wrong place, the wing folded off. And there was no way to fly the plane another 700 miles back to base without a wing. So there's just no chance. These guys had no chance. When the dice rolled wrong, it was over.
Tell the story about, which I had no idea, about Charles Lindbergh and how he helped the war effort when he came over there to assist.
Yeah, you know, I think for most of us think of Lindbergh in a pretty unflattering light.
Yeah.
You know, I have.
Me too.
He was this sort of vehement isolationist, whose isolationism kind of turned into a unfortunate embrace of the Nazis, to say the least, and whose private utterances were often, by my standards, obscenely racist. And yet there's this period in Lindbergh's life where he goes, late in the war, he goes to the South Pacific and begins flying planes as an observer. So he had given up his command. He's an officer in the Air Corps. And he gave up his command at the onset of war as a sort of a protest against the war. But then later he changed his mind about it, and he became especially zealous about the need to defeat the Japanese and to do it with planes over these long distances between islands. And yet so many of these planes, like the B-24, but also the P-38 and others, were so new that nobody knew quite what to do with them. They also weren't particularly good in some of the cases. And so Lindbergh devoted himself in a way that really is admirable if you can just look at that period somehow and put blinders onto the rest of sort of his story. There's this really admirable period in his life where he devotes himself to the cause of flying with other U.S. service members, you know, flyers from the different services, so aviators from the Navy, but also, you know, Marine Corps pilots and the airmen of the Army Air Forces. And he comes around all the different island bases through the South Pacific, and he flies in low, and he's fighting alongside these guys and teaching them how to fly so that their lives, they have a better chance. And it was really interesting to, he came in very close contact with the guys in my book, and so I ended up reading a lot about him, and to read his diaries is really a stunning thing, because his diaries from that period are so eloquently phrased,
yeah.
Descriptions of combat in the sky.
Yeah, it's amazing that he was able to get so much more out of the airplanes because of what? I don't know why, but he maybe because old geezers sometimes who have been doing something for years and years just have this ability, you know.
Yeah, that's right. He figured out how to fly the planes much further than anyone could. He knew how to sort of maximize the fuel efficiency using techniques that, you know, I'm not a pilot, so I don't fully understand it, but he would control his RPM and he would control his fuel mixture in ways that he would come back from a mission where everybody else was out of gas and he'd have 200 gallons left. And so he was summoned down to Brisbane, Australia by General MacArthur, who was leading that southern column across the South Pacific. And MacArthur asked him how far he thought he could go, if he thought he could do a straight shot from the northern coast of New Guinea all the way up to Palau. And he said he could, and MacArthur said, "Well, I want you to show me, and I want you to teach other guys how to do it." So Lindbergh went back to the northern coast of New Guinea, taught some other pilots what he had in mind. They went off and they flew to Palau, and they proved that it could be done. And then a couple weeks later, the guys in my book were flying that same route in their B-24 when they went down.
It's funny, you know, that makes me think again too, is just the idea of how much work you did. Exhausts me just thinking about it, because you even bring up the fact that there's this connection between Lindbergh and MacArthur based on MacArthur's wife of, what's that? I forgot what it was.
So
how do you get there? How do you do so much work that you get there?
I just love to read these old stories. You know? And they both have diaries, so that helped. And You know, the story is that years earlier, Lindbergh's mom and MacArthur's wife had met on a cruise ship. And so when MacArthur summoned Lindbergh down to talk about the combat radius he could eke out of a plane, they already had this kind of history and this kind of comfort level that made it possible for them to do this sort of online or really offline negotiation about how to improve the war effort without any, you know, any paperwork or any involvement from the rest of the command chain. Here was this civilian who really shouldn't have been in the war
at all. It's so funny. I found it fascinating, but then I thought, how the hell does he know this? You know, it's like reading the footnotes in a David Foster Wallace book, you know? It's just...
Well, thanks. I enjoy doing the research. In some ways, it's the most fun part, you know?
Yeah, I know. That's what I was saying about the bibliography. If I just took the time to read everything that you've read, it's amazing. It really is amazing.
It's fun.
But then again, you know, you had some families that just didn't want to talk to you too, right?
There was one family that asked me not to do any more interviews with the older members of the family. And I had to think about whether that was something I would agree to. I'd been doing interviews with the older members of the family, and they were happy to talk. And then a younger member of the family asked me not to contact them anymore because this younger member of the family had decided that he wanted to write something about it himself.
Huh.
And I ended up honoring that request with some sadness. Other than that, I was able to speak with the family members pretty freely, and I certainly, you know, got to know some of them better than others. The Doyle family I got pretty close with, and the family of Jimmy Doyle's best friend on the plane, Johnny Moore, I ended up forming a pretty close bond with one of Johnny's cousins, and then other members of other families. You know, I would reach out to them and spend some time chatting with them. But in many cases, the people who knew the lost men were themselves starting to fade, and their memories weren't so great, so I could only get the slightest details from them.
You know, there's something about research and the freedom of the press that came up while I was reading this book, which is the fact that they, you know, just released the transcripts of the 911 calls from Sandy Hook, and I can't bring myself to click on any link to lead me to those. I don't want to hear those calls.
And you and me both, brother. I feel the same way. I know they're out there. I sort of feel like I might learn something important to know or something. Honor the memory somehow. There might be a reason for doing so, but I can't do it.
I find it, you know, I always have the ability to observe my inner psyche working from the outside, and I wonder why it is. Why can't I click on that link? And I don't know exactly why I can't, but I know I can't. I just can't do it. And at the same point, I guess, I forgot who the lawsuit was by. Was it AP? I can't remember. I understand that they're entitled to them. I understand that.
I think there's a kind of reporting that's out there that I couldn't do, and that's probably part of it, you know. I also probably just don't have the courage to do war reporting. Today, we're recording this on December 5th. Today is the 2-year anniversary of the death of a great war photographer named Tim Hetherington, who shot the cover of my book, and I've been thinking about him all day. He was just one of the bravest people you could ever hope to meet, and he was always overseas in the line of fire, sometimes intervening in situations to try to make them better, other times photographing them, and I just have such respect for that work, but I can't imagine having the courage to do it myself.
Yeah, you even talk about the cover a little bit. It's a great cover.
Thanks.
And, you know, I have an independent bookstore, and it's like everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but of course everybody does. And so it's really good for, did they vet the covers with you? Did Riverhead, or did you pick it yourself? How did it work?
They did. We talked about it some. There were a couple different options. There was a sort of an orange version, and then there was a sort of a blue-green version, and we went with the blue-green version.
Yeah, it's better.
And then there was a little bit of movement in the typeset. And then there's a plane, a B-24, that's sort of placed near the top of the cover as though it were in the scene, but the photo was taken in 2008 when Tim Hetherington and I were were in Palau with the military recovery unit that was looking into this site. So it was interesting to see how, you know, how many ways it could be, the story could be kind of summarized visually on the cover. You know, we also experimented with a couple different titles to sort of see what felt right.
Yeah, I think it's good that there's a subtitle, because otherwise, you know, you could almost say, other than the fact it doesn't say a novel, you might look at it as a novel.
Yeah, and that was it's funny you should say that. That was a real concern, and there were conversations about that, about how to make sure people knew that it was a true story.
Yeah, and you know, you're going to have people that are going to say, or maybe they already have, that this is historical fiction, and I know that would make you feel, I would, if it was me, it would be insulting, because it's not at all, and I think everything you've put in there, actually, there's nothing you add it. I don't think there's, you know, moods or feelings or conversations that are anything but accurate, correct?
Right. No, every single, you know, word of it is verifiable. But I would be, in some other sense, thrilled if people mistake it for fiction. I mean, you know, I think that I'm drawn to nonfiction as a reporter because maybe I'm sort of simple-minded. I've also drawn to writing nonfiction because I just want to know, you know, how the real nuts and bolts of things happen in the world around me, and it's a wonderful job to have. You just go around and ask anybody you want, any question you want, anywhere you want, and most people will answer. But I do think that at the level of craft, you find the highest examples in the world of literature. And so, you know, there's no reason in my mind that you can't aspire to tell a nonfiction story with the sort of linguistic flair or some attempt at it that's present in novels.
But it's true, though, that you really do stick to what you know happened, because there's this massive question that is left in the book, which is why, is it Arnett? Why they switched pilots at the very end, and you still don't know why.
Right. There are a few things that we will never know, and in a way, that to me is the lesson that I learned, and that I hope people will find for themselves in the process of hearing this story, is that, you know, the search for definite answers is both important to pursue and meaningful to families, and also at the same time something that you could do forever. And at some point you have to choose where you've found enough and where you can't. So there's a question that persists to this day as to why the pilot of the plane was piloting that day instead of another guy. There are only two possible explanations, but we don't know which one it is.
Yeah.
And there's another question. One of the guys on the plane was flying in a position of the plane that simply vanished, no pun intended. It was this part of the plane, he's probably in it, and it's never been found. It was nowhere near the rest of the plane was found. So, you know, at some point, what ends up being meaningful to a lot of MIA families is that the effort has been made and not abandoned, rather than that the answers have been finite. And in this case of this plane, in 10 of the 11 instances, there's either a definite answer or something very close to it. And I think it's the effort to find those answers that ends up having the most meaning for families, rather than the answers themselves.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways of looking at closure, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, I was thinking about it as a novel for a second, and one part, I guess, where I really felt like it was a novel was when I got really angry at the girl who wrote back to, I forgot which one it was, who wrote back that someone was flirting with her at work that day.
Oh, yeah.
I was so mad at her. How could she write that to him?
I know. I know. And then you read Johnny's letter back to her, and it's, it really, the littlest things like that could really hurt these guys.
You know? Oh, God, yeah.
Their life on base was just, it was brutal in this, they were sort of being cosseted into agony. You know, they had this awful juxtaposition between their extreme exposure and vulnerability in the sky of combat, and then the sight back on base, which was way at the rear of the line, and in some cases the airfields were on islands that were simply beautiful, and there were dances, and they had dinner in mess halls with, you know, silverware, and when they landed their planes from this horrific experience of watching their friends die in combat and planes burning and spiraling down the sky, they'd get home and then be offered cookies before they even barely got off the airfield.
Yeah, that was funny too, and I didn't even think about that, with wax on the airstrip offering them orange juice and cookies.
Yeah, and it's such a, in a way, that part of the, I think that part of their combat experience, when you talk to these flyers who are still alive from those same days and who knew these guys, they described that part as being not scary or you know, traumatizing in the same way that the combat was, but this perpetual ping-ponging back and forth between the most vulnerable that you could, the most helpless you could be in combat, and then back on base in this incredibly pampered and kind of boring lifestyle with no family members. I mean, it's not like you sat around and just relished the beach time. You know, your whole family was somewhere else. You were just here with all these guys waiting for your next combat mission. And this perpetual going back and forth between the boredom of base and the horror of combat, I think, took a very, very distinct toll, you know. We're much more aware of what, say, the Marine infantrymen went through when they were storming beaches at, you know, Tarawa or Peleliu than we are aware of what it was like for these Pacific flyers to have to shift their mind every day into the determination to go back into war, and then at night try to turn it off again.
Yeah, it's like some of the letters back home where they're, you can tell, I wish you were, you know, it's like, weather is beautiful, wish you were here. It's like, you know, they want them to come so they can swim in the beaches and how beautiful the beaches are, and it's kind of like, I'm on this incredible vacation, I wish I had my family with me.
Right. It would be a vacation. It'd be a great vacation if we weren't
dying,
you know, at war.
Yeah.
Crazy. It's a crazy life. There were all these, you know, coconuts falling from the trees and pineapples and, you know, monkeys swinging from the waist guns of the planes while they were parked. And yet the whole thing was just a nightmare for them, because they knew that the next morning they were going to have to get up and go back and just roll the dice and see if they got shot down or not.
Or watch their best friend die. That's almost as bad.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about all of it is these islands were really meaningless in the sense of almost everything except for the fact that you were moving onward or being pushed back. That's all it
right.
was.
This right. Is, yeah, it's so true. That's such an important point. I mean, these Pacific islands, you know, when I was just out on Tarawa last month, I could not stop thinking about how insane it is that in the space of 3 days, 5,000 or 6,000 American and Japanese infantrymen died. They slaughtered each other on this little half a square mile island for nothing. I mean, this island is nowhere. It's in the middle of nowhere, hundreds of miles from anything else. Nobody would ever go fight for this island, but it became absolutely essential. You know, in the series of sort of stepping stones across the Pacific, this one tiny little island was essential for the Americans to be able to reach first the Marshalls and then the Marianas, and then from the Marianas direct flights on the heavy bombers over Tokyo. So without this one little island, the whole war plan would be interrupted. And that's the very peculiar thing about the Pacific, is you just had to take an airfield where you could, and it might be in the middle of nowhere. So you're fighting these brutal, bloody, hand-to-hand combat battles over sometimes more than days, sometimes weeks. You know, in the case of Peleliu, they were fighting things forever. And yet it's for nothing, for an island that nobody would really want.
It's such a horrible thing that I think you have to, especially you as a researcher, have to suspend your disbelief at what happens when you peel back the skin of civility that normally, you know, it's like the skin on a creme brulee, you know, you tap it and then you go through it. It's a very thin layer of civilization we live in.
Yeah.
It's and it's funny, too, if you go from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to World War I to World War II, and now you have drones that fly over and drop a bomb that we think kills one bad person. Well, it doesn't. It kills the bad person and his mother and his nephew and his son, and we don't even we don't even think about that. I don't think a lot of people do.
Right, we don't even know. Most of us don't even know when a drone strike is happening or who it's happening against, or, you know.
Well, like, it's like today, Snowden's documents indicate that, you know, we're intercepting three billion cell phone calls a day.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
I know. There's safety in numbers, though, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think you talk about that, right?
Yeah.
You talk about the B-24s. The idea is to get as close as you can. When originally they thought you wanted... Did you talk about that, or am I making that up?
I'm not sure exactly which aspect of it you mean. But
I just read somewhere, and it might have been on my YouTube searching and all that, about how they eventually realized that the planes should be flying as close together as possible.
Oh, yeah, that's in the book.
Yeah.
There's a line from a gunner named Al Jose who flew with the guys on the crew, and he talks about how when he first got to combat, he didn't understand why all these other airplanes kept coming in close to his gun window. He would scream and shout and wave them away. And then he realized that the best thing he could have is other planes in the sky next to him.
Right, it's like
a sort of a strategic calculation.
Yeah, it's like a school of fish, you know, staying tight together to escape the shark rather than getting eaten.
Yeah.
Well, we have about like 1 minute left, so one question I wanted to ask you was, this is your first book. Why did you decide, one, do you have others in mind? Do you feel like you might switch to fiction? And why was this the first and only book you decided to publish?
That's a great question. the short answer is I don't really know what happened here. But when I started to put together the magazine article that I intended to write, I felt deeply dissatisfied. I mean, it was 2008. I still didn't know anything, really. I didn't understand yet the depth of what families experienced. I had just met a few family members and seen them crying and trying to convey to me what they experienced and how much they still suffered from the lack of answers. And I had briefly met Pat Scannon, who had spent so many years of his life searching for this plane and others. I didn't really understand why. I wanted to understand why, and there was just no way to do that in the magazine piece. And so all these unfinished questions just stuck with me, and when I filed the magazine story, I kept reporting. I just stayed in touch with all the same people and kept asking all the same questions and trying to find out more. And then at some point I realized I was writing a book and I might as well commit to it, because that's what I was doing anyway. As to whether I would switch, I've been trying to figure that out. You know, I mean, I just published this big article in the Times Magazine that's sort of an example of what I normally do. I just write maybe four major magazine articles a year, and that's it. That's always been my job, and I've always loved it. And I never felt compelled to write it longer form. But with this book, I really do feel like I found a great creative joy in trying to handle text, so much text. It feels different to paint on such a larger canvas. And I think I might need to do it again.
Well, thanks so much for being here. I really have to break it up. I could ask you more and more questions, but my engineer is yelling at me frantically because I went over. So, in any event, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been fun to chat.
Likewise. Okay.
Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I have no idea who's going to be on next week. It could be Penumbra, Good Lord Bird, This Is How You Lose Her, or Hollow City. It'll be one of them. Thanks very much for joining us today.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.